I think the time-space continuum wins out over that's true. Truthiness. Hello and welcome to this month's episode of the Bike Portland podcast about bikes and low-car life in PDX, taped here at the Open Roads Broadcasting Studio. I'm Lillian Kerbake.
I'm Jonathan Moss.
And I'm Michael Anderson. Each month we go in-depth on a subject that matters to Portlanders who get around without a car.
And we do it in the time it takes the average Portlander to get to work.
This month on the show, we are shaking things up and leaving the facts behind.
Well, some of the facts.
The difference between the future and the past is that some facts stay true and some don't.
And this show will be coming to you from the future.
From several futures. We're calling this show, What If?
As in, what if we really did run out of oil?
Or what if there really were a war on cars?
Or what if Generation Z decided that Beaverton were the coolest place ever?
What would happen next?
We're going to be hypothesizing, extrapolating, and dreaming.
I am so excited about this show. Enjoy this. This was an idea that I pitched, actually based on a thing that the Portland's bike coordinator made, thinking about what would happen if Portland kept filling up with cars. What would we need to do? And he calculated that we would need like 17 whole new Powell Boulevards worth of space on the roads. So I thought about what are some other ridiculous things that could happen and like what would it force us to do or what would happen? And then I saw this City Lab piece the other day, and I'm going to read this portion of it just to communicate to the listeners what we're going for here in this mostly improvised podcast. But it's a scenario about Boston in 2030, and it says that Boston becomes a, quote, a dense city to the extreme degree. Freed of possessions by the sharing economy, young people flock to micro apartments just 135 to 160 square feet in size. The possessions they do own exist in local warehouses with a system of driverless valets to pick up and drop off items on demand, a sort of goods cloud. Autonomous bikes thrive, reducing the need for car ownership and creating streets friendly to pedestrians by day. At night, however, driverless urban freight vehicles take over the roads to replenish and relocate the shared stream of goods. Crazy stuff could be on the way in this unlikely but slightly plausible future. So we're going to be looking at some other unlikely but slightly plausible futures. And John, do you want to start with this first one? It's a long-standing by Portland dream, of course.
There'll be a lot of dreaming in this show for sure. Let's start off with this one. What if Portland actually built Dutch-style cycle tracks on every arterial?
What would happen? So do we want to like pass this? I think people should jump in when they have a thing. So if
it can be conversational. People can jump in. Okay.
So I mean, my first thought is just basically that mode share would jump almost overnight. Every single arterial, if MLK, if Grand, if they all had Dutch style,
like a nice turning intersection
and bike specific light.
And this all occurred overnight. We somehow got a $1 billion grant and put it in.
We wouldn't even need $1 billion, but yeah.
Okay.
I'm immediately drawn to the happy pictures, the basically Sunday parkways on all our major arterials, which is, I think, good estimation of what might happen, but there could be a darker side as well. I mean, if you have the existing sort of trip type that we have now with how many people drive cars, if we were to do that on every arterial overnight, let's say, or quickly, those trips, those cars would, I mean, where would people go that drive in there? Would that create so much animosity, so much backlash, so much, where would it all go?
There'd be so much queuing, right?
Yeah,
so
queuing would be.
There would just be.
It would actually be chaos because so many people would be trying to drive that next morning that the traffic system would fail because there isn't enough room for all the turn lanes and everything that we've got right now.
Right.
The cycle tracks would become like a refuge from the chaotic environment.
Right, which would be, of course, the point is that everybody would see, oh, this is actually now a better way to do it, right? But everybody would be angry because they would have to change in some way, right?
So it could be a tough transition.
Here's another
period.
Thing. What if all the space, I mean, most of the space could be taken just from parked cars. What if we eliminated every, the way we did this was by eliminating parked cars from almost every street in the city or every major street. And then there, all the parking would be off to the sides. You would still need some changes at the intersections, but that would be a way to do it without these queuing back.
Well, suddenly the two families that run the majority of private parking garages in Portland would, one, their general growth industry would be just booming. And suddenly it would just be all of the density that we say we need would suddenly be parking garage density, right? Hmm. So if you eliminate parking from all the arterials and all of the nearby side streets, what you've got is, you see in other cities, they've got these like small surface lots, these tiny little 200 by 200 parking lots that have like these Insta racks where they're able to double park.
Right.
And triple park.
And that would suddenly be financially viable because people would be willing to pay for that convenience. Yeah.
Right, because they wouldn't have anywhere else to park.
I think that's actually not a negative thing. I got in a little bit of trouble this during the whole density and auto parking issue that came up. I tried to write an editorial, kind of backfired. I don't think it really came across. But I think we need to do something to force some innovation in how we store cars. Mm-hmm. We really don't do that very well because there's no incentive, right? Because there's plenty of space to park them. So why aren't we building really cool underground things or putting on the roof or building little elevated towers?
Expensive.
Well, right. Okay. Right. So, but I think that'd be nice if someone would do that. It would alleviate, we'd have a place to store the thing. And of course, if you didn't need them eventually, which I would hope that we wouldn't need them, you could turn these things into parks or do something else, plant, vegetables in them or something. But, we could use some more innovative parking. I think it might also maybe finally create some sort of more active auto lobby, which I've always kind of fantasized about. Having a group that, like, when things pop up around the bike issue and stuff and around traffic issues in town, there's really no one
it's
to
support,
have.
At the moment, it's the Portland Business Alliance, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like, but
they're a pretty weak auto lobby for an auto lobby, right?
Yeah,
They only play like super defense,
and they're shadow conspiracy. They do it by making phone calls to powerful people. They don't go on Twitter, and they don't participate in public discussions. They're not going to come to an event we put on.
Is there
an
auto lobby in Copenhagen?
I don't think so.
I don't know. I mean, there's certainly an auto lobby at this in this country, but it's all at the federal level.
But
right?
if we had it, can you imagine a nonprofit group like of activists that were pushing more auto access and saying, heck no, we're being marginalized. Right. We're upset. We want more
auto.
We
did have that.
That would be fantastic.
You know, we had that. It's called AAA.
Well, right. To
and
some, but
and
yeah.
It turned out they won, and they stopped having to.
That's true. They've had
Darn
to
it.
Sleep
guess,
for many years,
I guess,
we'll reawaken them
so it's
when
not,
Portland
well,
builds Dutch-style cycle tracks right. every
well,
year.
And I want to point out that now AAA is offering roadside bike assistance.
Yeah.
What was the, let's say, the League of American Cyclists.
For cars.
Yeah.
Has been so successful that they are now supporting other modes in roadside assistance, which is their cute program they're now known for, despite the fact that originally they were like, let's build roads through all the parks.
Yeah.
Like,
right. Okay.
I mean, it gets back to my desire for having some group that's like an auto lobby. It's just so we could force this conversation about what we should do in the future of our city and why we need to improve bicycle access. And if we had these Dutch-style cycle tracks on arterials, it would force that. It would also give us something I talk about a lot, which is an actual demonstration of this thing we're arguing for all these years.
Right.
Which is, a facility that 8 to 80, young people, old people feel safe.
Right.
So then when we go over to the PBA, whoever, you can say, this is what we're talking about. Look at this. It's Sunday Parkways every day on Sandy Boulevard. Isn't that awesome? And I think that would change the tenor of the debate throughout the city overnight.
Right. Okay. Next one. Another dream. What if gasoline went to $18 a gallon, which, Lily, you said that's the full environmental cost.
That's been estimated as the full environmental cost of a gallon of gasoline when used in a private motor vehicle. So what would happen?
You would see. I just instantly think of the massive impact on transportation to jobs for people that couldn't afford that.
Yeah.
And food.
How would they? Yeah, and like the transportation bill, you'd have some major.
The suburbs would be immediately devastated. I assume. Well, actually, Portland, there's a lot of jobs in Washington County. Clackamas County would be devastated.
Right.
So I just from a transit perspective, the MAX would probably start running way more frequent trains.
Right.
So like the max would be buying rolling stock. That's how much they nothing would be in the yard during the day, you know. Just because you would exactly, it's those Washington County jobs for people that live in the central city or live in Gresham that work in Washington County. Those people would mode shift really quickly.
Mm-hmm. We would also get a huge shift in the way we powered cars, right? So we would immediately have, like, Tesla would be suddenly pumping out as many cars as General Motors, and right, they would suddenly become much more valuable to find some other way to power cars, and people would do it. Most people would do that.
Right. I mean, I think the forces that dominate our transportation discussion in America, the auto industry, basically, they would find a way around it. I don't think they're going to sit idly by while people start to change their travel behaviors. There's way too much money and power wrapped up in maintaining the current system.
The VMT tax would be really fascinating around this, right? Because essentially what we would probably see is a lot less people would be driving. Yet the cost of gasoline is much higher, but the gas tax stays flat. So suddenly we have the same amount of revenue coming in to build roadways, but less people driving. And we know immediately that less people will be driving, right? Like, it's a pretty, in economics, we call things elastic or inelastic. Inelastic goods, you're going to buy the same amount of them no matter how much the cost goes up. It's going to take a long time for you to change your behavior versus pomegranates get really expensive in the summer at the grocery store. And you're just like, oh, I'm not going to buy a $7 pomegranate. And that's a super elastic cost. And gasoline generally falls into the category of, like, it's elastic on a national scale. Like, we see peaks and valleys during the summer and we see people react to gasoline. But in a day-to-day personal level, it's a fairly inelastic good. People have to drive to work. They drive about the same amount, so
that's true. We did see, what was it? Is it like 2008? It was the only comparison I can think of when the gas prices were so crazy high. It was up to $4 or $5, and I was like, you know, there was a lot of excitement in the bike world because it seemed like there was this real tangible shift toward biking. Okay, so what if millennials? There was just a new report that came out showing that millennials are going to be driving way less, significantly less, as they get older. What if they actually started driving more? Well, I think you're going to see an immediate sort of land use density impact, right? Because let's say by the time that happens, we're only adding more and more people to urban areas. We're getting more and more dense, and we're doing it sort of. I mean, the urban planning field is moving away from people driving, so we're investing in transit and biking and all that. So all of a sudden, if it doesn't go that way, there's going to be quite a crunch potentially, you know, so.
Yeah, and one of the things I think is interesting around this question is, like, okay, so millennials start driving more, but do they change all of the other consumptive patterns that we see millennials shifting, which we see more and more millennials wanting to live in the urban core, which we attribute and other people attribute to wanting to drive less, wanting to be able to live in these walkable neighborhoods.
I don't actually attribute it. I think it's the other way around. I think people like the urban core, and therefore they're driving less.
Okay. We've got a chicken and egg issue.
Yeah.
So if everybody still lives in the urban core, but everybody is driving more suddenly, is that driving more over the zero value of current, or is that driving more, meaning millennials drive more than previous generations?
Yeah, well, more than previous generations.
Ooh.
What if they...
We're screwed if that happens.
What does that look like? So that mean, I think that you see... I think this is sort of happening in Portland right now. I think that there is... that. Actually, personally, I think that the millennial low-car thing is driven by mostly by their like of cities, because cities are more awesome than they used to be, and by their being poor because young people's jobs are crappier than they used to be. And it's actually old people from the 70s who learned to bike in the 70s who are driving a huge amount of the boom in biking, and we are the paranoid parents of the 90s, their children are now starting to come into the biking age, and I think those people did not learn how to bike. I think there are lots of people who didn't learn how to bike. I think this is plausible, actually. I think there are a bunch of people coming up who never learned to bike, and they're going to be a huge threat to everything we're doing.
And they had the helicopter parent. They had all the overprotect. Right. Yeah, right. A huge threat to what we were doing. You sound like you're some war general.
I am. Yeah. I'm part of the conspiracy. If this happens, I think we're going to see what we see in Portland, which is a stagnation of enthusiasm for biking and transit investment, and stagnation of use in those things, and increasing crowding in cities. And I think cities are going to become more annoying again.
Annoying. I thought crowding made cities great.
Maybe it does. Maybe you're right.
Well, it makes cities great if there's not cars.
Right. You can only see the advantages of crowding if you aren't like moving around in a giant metal block.
People don't hate density. They hate the density of cars. And I think that's one of the key things is that like a lot of people, a lot of the discussion that we see around like in my neighborhood, I live in this, you know, the inner east side, and we've got all this like, oh, I hate these new apartments coming in, blah, blah, blah. And then you get to the core of it, and it's not like they don't want new people in the neighborhood.
Right.
It's that they don't want more cars
underneath them. Right.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly.
They don't want anybody parking in front of their
house.
That's
an interesting reframe. Yeah. Okay. Next one.
So what if we gave everyone a free bike?
Free. No money. Just give them a bike.
I guess so.
Yeah.
Everybody in Portland.
It's good. It's
that's how people describe bike sharing sometimes who don't understand bike sharing. They're like, you're giving out free bikes.
Right.
That's craziness.
They'll all get stolen. Remember the Yellow Bike Project?
Right. Right. So what happened with the Yellow Bike products? People didn't take care of their bikes.
They didn't. Yeah, they had no
perceived
value. Most
of them ended up in the Willamette, I'm fairly sure.
Right.
Yeah, they had no value. They also weren't locked. So, I mean, if you gave people a free bike, they'd probably lock it. Nobody locked the Yellow
Bike. Yeah, it's your own bike, right?
Yeah.
So we're I'm just going to say there is an organization that has been giving free bikes out for a very long time.
How does that work?
That I work for, called the Creator Commuter Program at the Community Cycling Center. And what they do is they focus on low-income people that don't have a car, that want to have access to a bike. And
so it's a self-selected group of people who are expressing interest in this.
Yeah, that come through social service agencies. And it's a workforce development thing. So the idea is that like you use this bike to get access. And what they've learned over the years is that people need to also get all these other things for them to be successful as bike commuters. Lights, lock, panniers,
right.
A little bit of riding training about how to ride in traffic, about route planning, rain gear. All of these things have to be part of the package. Otherwise, the bike is just going to sit in their garage.
Right.
What they've discovered, and this is part of this is a social service program delivery, but a lot of this is just human nature. They need to have education to have buy-in about this. So, like, they need to want to be part of this program, and then they have to sit through 6 hours of training about how to ride a bike, how to plan your route, all these things in order for them to be effective users of it. So
absent being able to roll out a program like that for every resident.
If we just gave a bike to everyone?
It brings up the question is what's stopping people from biking? Is it the fact that they don't have a bike or they just don't want to do it? Right? I mean, there's plenty of people that have a bike in the garage that they're
not using.
There's
a ton of people.
So if we gave them a free one, there'd be another bike hanging in the garage collecting dust. Or would there be a visible impact on ridership?
I don't think there would be. I think there's a visible impact if we particularly gave them to people who wanted them, who had some sort of barrier.
Well, then there would be a visible impact if we gave
getting
them to everybody,
them.
But not more worth the cost.
Yeah.
And I think it has to come coupled with comprehensive programming.
Yeah. Right.
I think giving people free things without, I mean, this is maybe just my nonprofit hat on, but it rarely works. Mm-hmm. Like, just being like, here's a free bagel is not.
Right. So that's it then, Lily. So you said earlier you wanted to talk about some solutions to not just what is. So there you go. We have it. Mm-hmm. Solution is let's do free bikes, but let's make it a program, sort of a state run or city run program where it comes with education and gear and stuff.
Which
and then,
does exist and it's funded through federal money and it's goes to the Community Cycling Center.
Right.
Yeah. Basically,
give some more money to Lily's company.
Basically doing that more. Okay. Yeah. I hear you saying.
Like that.
So
ramping
so,
that up.
So the solution is to give money to the Community Cycling Center.
There you go. There you go.
Great.
Good.
I like it.
Good.
Wow.
We
I don't know
somewhere.
How I just turned it into that, but I totally That's did.
Great. You deserve a raise for that one.
Speaking of bikes, what if you could go into Walmart, Target, big box store, and get an actual real city bike, like a functioning city bike, fenders, lights, everything you would need on a bike-wise. Because now the big problem is a lot of America that shops in those places, even if they do get curious about bikes, they go in there, they end up getting a bike that basically doesn't work. They hate it.
You can't see the difference between a good bike and a bad
bike. Their experience is really, really bad, so they don't start to love cycling, so they don't ever do it.
I want to make sure that we're not just, like, I know Michael doesn't identify as a bike geek, but you're much bigger of a bike geek than the average population, right?
That's true.
And I want to make sure that, like, this is not us being bike geeky. Like, there's a...
Right. Oh, there's a huge difference. I was almost driven away from biking permanently because I bought a terrible bike from a big store, and I did not realize how bad it was going to be. It was really heavy and stupid, and I never used it. I stopped using it almost immediately when I was in Longview.
This is like down to an equipment thing, and I know we don't like to call, you know, commuting biking a sport, but like when I was a figure skater, I would regularly have people be like, "Oh, I don't like skating because it hurts my ankles," and I'd be like, "Yeah, but that's because you're wearing the rental skates at the rink that are just terrible. They're meant to just be beat up and they don't support your ankles at all. And I'm like, what I have is like, I can't even move my ankles in these boots because they're completely, and that's exactly what a good bike is, right? Like a good bike is the equipment. You don't notice the equipment, right? Like a good bike, you're spending more time thinking about traffic. You're spending more time thinking about like, I'm moving my legs. You're not thinking about like, this is so heavy. It is the worst thing I've ever pedaled up.
So I think that the price of the first thing that would happen if this happened was the price of a good bike would fall from like $300 to $200.
But it would also happen in places that are traditionally places where people don't bike for other reasons too, which is bad. You know, they go out, the streets are really fast. There's long distances. They can't even find their way out of the subdivision because the streets are all dead ends and, you know, cul-de-sacs. Right. So, you know, would it really have that big of an impact? It'd be a bunch of the bike geeks from the cities going to the big boxes to get a cheap city bike is what it would do.
Well, and I actually think that what would end up happening is we know that when people start riding, they become advocates. And when people start liking biking, they become advocates.
That's true. That's the key.
It could hasten the development of better biking in different places.
And it's like it's not like we don't have a model for this what if. So like Germany, which is like still incredibly car-centric. Mm-hmm. They love cars in Germany. It's the only country in Europe that has giant cars, American-sized cars. And they have the Autobahn, and they have a lot of suburban development patterns where there are cul-de-sacs. Like, this is not Amsterdam, right? Like there is no city, almost no city in Germany that has sort of those land use patterns or infrastructure. But what ends up happening, like in Germany, you can walk into a supermarket and buy a city bike. And I can buy a city bike as a 4'11" woman. I can buy a bike that me as a bike geek is comfortable riding around. And you know what happens? You get a much better mode share without level of infrastructure improvement that we think is necessary in the United States.
Mm-hmm. But you're right. So like, actually, maybe this is a thing. Maybe if biking continues to become more popular, maybe Walmart is going to start selling nice bikes, and maybe we're going to have a huge shift towards higher mode share nationwide and advocacy because of that. And it just hasn't happened yet because Walmart hasn't discovered this was a market.
I think a little bit of that is happening. Like, Walmart's not selling public bikes yet, but there's like,
they're selling the Hollandia. Remember that? Selling a Dutch-style bicycle. I don't think the quality isn't great, but they recognize, because their retail people there are very sophisticated, they recognize this thing, which is an urban biking sort of renaissance going on, and you know, and they sold this bike called the Hollandia, which was like a Dutch upright. Mm. I don't know how it's going. It was a few years ago. We did a little story about it. But so they do notice it to some degree, you know. But yeah, they do have the power to sort of shift, you know, cultural behavior for sure.
We're recommending that. What if?
Yeah. Right. What if we didn't do so much freaking planning for every project? What if Portland just came in with a bulldozer and or a stripe of paint? Just a stripe. Just a little stripe.
One stripe.
You guys.
Because a stripe in this town can take 2 years.
Right, exactly. Yeah. What would happen, Jonathan?
Well, and I don't even, I think there's like a gradient, right? So one of the things that I've seen, I was on the Burnside High Crash Corridor Committee, which was like essentially like an ad hoc committee where ODOT was like, we got issues. It's identified as a high crash corridor. We need to fix something. There needs to be a solution. Let's convene a very small group of folks that care about this. And the public process, while is extensive compared to what if we just got a bulldozer, was really not extensive compared to like Williams. And it was really interesting to see, because I don't know if you've been to East Burnside in the past 3 weeks, but the recommendations that were passed in like May are now being striped this week.
If we had just come in and done that, then it would have deferred the conversation that needed to happen around Williams longer, and I think the city of Portland, it would not be thinking about race and class in the same way that it is now thinking about systematically. So part of the reason we do the process is because it creates this feedback loop, right?
Yeah.
So one of the consequences would be that the city would piss off more people over the years, and like it would build the sorts of like backlashes that we saw surrounding Williams.
Yeah, we would make a lot of mistakes.
Right.
Right. And I'm kind of torn because I believe very strongly in public participation. Right. I mean, that's a big part of my life for the last 9 years, and my job every day is dealing with people weighing in on topics. I believe it's very important. But at the same time, you know, you can go too far, I think. And I also think, you know, you could, I think it's a healthy debate to say, what if we had less process? Would we probably make some mistakes because we wouldn't be able to tap into the community wisdom. But then again, we'd have more stuff on the ground, so you'd have more buy-in potentially. That's one of the biggest things that I love about Jeanette Sadek Khan is she was a real believer in proving mm-hmm. your point, getting out there and proving to people what the heck your goals and vision is right. by doing it in the street.
Right. Well, and then the other thing is that she would take things back, right? So, like, part of it was they were conceived as right. trials, and then, like, a bunch of the things that she did didn't work, or several of them anyway, and they just got rid of them.
Yeah, and they would do them sort of as half measures to right. claim the space, right? She right. would go take the space, and then if they worked out, you would see it actually be improved and develop more. But if right. it didn't, they could pull it
and
back.
We're talking about New York City. I don't know if
we yeah.
yeah, sorry. Yeah. One of the things that I think is really interesting around the whole implementation versus, okay, so essentially I think the do it now, ask permission later is the Portland Development Commission model that they had through the 70s and 1980s. Mm. And clearly there were a lot of problems with that. We have a lot of really interesting things that we did during that era because of PDCs, sort of like bulldoze now, mm-hmm. ask questions later policy. But there were also huge impacts mm. on marginalized communities because there wasn't a public process. Right. And PDC's been sort of like, PDC's kind of tune these days is, we used to be bad, but we're better now. Here's a meeting you can come to.
Right, exactly. Which is not that good. So that's part of the problem. Like, the public process that we use now is also racist and classist and terrible and ineffective. And
there's just more of it. There's
right,
a lot of it.
Right,
but it's
exactly.
not good.
Yeah. So, like, I think that, like, when you're using projects in the right way, a demo project is itself public process. And we should start thinking about demos as the first step or the main phase of a public process is putting a demo in place. Consider that.
Are you proposing we collect real data instead right. of just talk about
exactly.
things?
That's what I'm
so
saying.
Michael's solution yes. is like this compromise. Yes, use the bulldozers,
right.
but
right.
don't mess up stuff too much that right. you can't take
it
back.
And the thing is that the projects we did in the 60s that birthed the current public process thinking, those you couldn't take the back the Mount Hood
right.
Freeway.
Right.
And
you couldn't take back raising the entire Boise neighborhood
exactly.
for a legacy Emanuel expansion
exactly.
that never happened.
Right. But the projects we're doing now, like bike projects and pedestrian plazas and the sort of things to make cities livable, those are things you can reverse. So I feel like it's a new thing that the public process hasn't adjusted to.
Well, and we spend a lot of money on public process.
Yeah.
Just to be
yeah,
clear, this is not a free right. this is not a free conversation that we're having. The amount of staff time we put into it, the amount of opportunity costs that people like yeah. me and Jonathan and Michael
right.
spend going to these meetings, and just generally, like, we pay outside consulting firms that all they do is public process stuff.
Right.
Like, there are whole firms that their whole job
good point.
And existence is to facilitate this public process. And what if we didn't have, what if I literally do not have to go directly to a comprehensive plan meeting after we record this podcast,
right.
which is my like sixth of the past 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Like,
right.
you know, and that's not all the same committee.
I mean, this is a big what if, but we actually had something recently in town that was almost a direct example of this different approach. The Better Block Project on 3rd Avenue, there was some process. I mean, people talked about it, obviously. It wasn't sort of bulldozer overnight thing, but it was not the typical City of Portland process, super long, drawn-out thing. And, you know, it was demonstration. It was temporary. It was proof. It showed what was possible. It got people excited about a vision. And there's some talks that are existing and currently happening, and it's moving on. So, I mean, I think that adds weight to the argument that we should try something different and take a different approach on the process project issue.
What if we had a toll on one of our main downtown bridges?
One.
No one would use it. They'd just
yeah,
go to another
we'd
one.
All go to the
right. Well, then we need tolls on all the
tolls on all the bridges.
And then the economy would collapse.
No.
No?
Not at all. Not at all.
Okay.
We would just pay it.
People would pay it. Is it inelastic or elastic, Lily?
Suddenly, my office space on the east side would become a lot more valuable.
That's true. You'd get a bunch of development on the east side.
Yeah. Right. You would get a ton of development in that industrial east side area. And what I think would end up happening as someone who goes to a lot of comp plan meetings is that the industrial sanctuary in Inner East would freak out.
I wonder if we'd see a spike in private development of bridges that the
ooh.
City wouldn't manage.
Ooh, that's
people be like, or ferries or segways.
Ferries. Something I've been interested in general is, like, whenever I go to the East Coast is how, like seamless just tolls are just part of a budget of the average commuter, you know? Like, because when you're on the New Jersey Turnpike and you're just like, holy crap, but like every freaking just 9 miles.
Right. And people you're pay just it, like, though.
But it's all paid very seamlessly. And
home household budgets and housing decisions. And
yeah.
Well, I think the question people are going to be thinking about that are listening is, well, would people on bikes have to pay and people on foot have to pay?
No.
And well, I don't know the answer to that, but I do think that if we started charging tolling on the bridge to downtown and it didn't apply to bikes or peds,
oh man,
it would be amazing. Yeah, I mean, we would see a huge surge. We would probably see a lot of people parking.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Then there would be that would pay for the parking garages on the east side.
We
would use those parking garages to remove the street parking. Then we build the cycle tracks. Boom.
figured it out. This is the best episode ever.
Just to be clear, it is actually currently illegal for us to charge tolls on that bridge.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
It's a what if.
We have to actually change federal law, just to be clear.
Yeah, I know what I'm writing about.
The OMSI lot actually has this problem right now, just based on parking costs in downtown. So the OMSI lot down on the Inner East Side is, you know, it's a short walk over the Hawthorne Bridge from that part of the OMSI lot. And they have a lot of people who try to park in that lot while they're at work for the day and then head over. And OMSI doesn't put a lot of money into enforcement around that. They sort of put like a nasty gram on your car saying like, meh. But it apparently has been like a consistent issue for them.
That makes sense.
So I think what we'd see is OMSI would get a lot better parking enforcement really quickly if there was a toll.
Right.
As a member of the Budget Advisory Committee, I'll ask this one. What if PBOT actually had a healthy budget and we could build all of the stuff that we need?
Well, it would sort of bring into stark relief the big question of, are we not building stuff because we don't have money or because we don't have the political will to do it? I know that there's a lot of people in City Hall that would be jumping for joy at all the paving they could do.
Probably.
And
we'd probably have incredibly smooth road services.
We'd have fast roads.
We'd get those bumpy greenways would finally be smoothed out. You know, that would be nice.
And there would also be plenty of, it's clear there are enough people in PBOT. If people had what they wanted, if everybody could like dole out the resources to all the constituents within PBOT right now, then there would be lots of money spent on awesome bike stuff because there are lots of people who care deeply about improving bike stuff and walking stuff and transit stuff in the short term. But in the long term, I feel like a big reason that Portland is so great for bikes is because we've been broke for so long. We were this Rust Belt, basically, city for decades that had
Just call Portland a Rust Belt
city.
I think
demographically, what? The North Pacific Northwest was Rust Belt until the 80s. And
I'm not going to get into
so we had to be right. So you're saying it's because of that we had to innovate and be lean and we couldn't spend money on huge highway projects.
We didn't have money to widen the bridges, so we striped the bike lanes on the Hawthorne and or added the bike lanes to the Hawthorne sidewalks, and then that created more bike capacity. We didn't build freeways because it was expensive, and as a result it was annoying to get downtown with the car.
I'm curious what it would do to the process question. Would we just be suffocated and like would we be paralyzed by process, right? Because all of a sudden you'd have projects popping up all over the place. Each of them would have to have their own 12-month process
with
30 people
process
on the advisory committee, and all of a sudden, you know, we'd have this huge bloated process situation.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so actually, what about Germany or the Netherlands, right? These guys do not scrimp on their budgets. Right. They have lots of awesome roads.
Exactly.
But they also have awesome bikeways.
We would have beautiful, beautiful things. I think we forget in the U.S. No, I think we forget.
Jonathan just got this very far away look in his eyes.
You know what?
You could see the cycle tracks reflected in his pupils.
There's a real reason because last year I was able to go to Copenhagen and Amsterdam. And I went.
Revenue
absolutely. Spending. And I went to the Hovenring. And it was amazing, this elevated bicycle path up over this gnarly freeway thing that they couldn't get across safely. Mm-hmm. And they just made the most beautiful piece of infrastructure. And I think in America, we've lost this idea that transportation infrastructure can be really beautiful because we've been most of the money we've spent on ugly, ugly freeways, right? And now we don't have any money because of that, so everybody's looking to cut corners. I mean, we're lucky here. We have an aerial tram. That's kind of pretty. But we could build really beautiful things.
The aerial tram is like such a great example of this too, because people that don't use it still like whenever you bring it up, they're like, nah, 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 we spent so much money on that. People that use it every day are like, this is the best thing that has ever happened. Like, and I was someone who had like a much more skeptical take on it until I worked under it every morning for a year. And then I was sort of like, oh, this is transformative.
Right.
And, you know, recently that Bike Portland had that editorial that was like why I drive to work, essentially. Mm-hmm. And one of the comments that I really found interesting on there was someone describing back when they worked at OHSU before the tram and how they had to choose to drive and how different their commute would have been when that option existed. And that is such a great example of like a thing that is incredibly expensive and incredibly bold to build. Like, right. We're building a flying tram up a hill. Like, it's
with
a huge. As someone who worked there, that has a line with 3-minute headways. Yeah. Like, no one who uses it every day is skeptical about the tram. I'm just going to say that. Like, I don't think there's a single person who regularly uses the tram that's like, oh man, if only we hadn't spent this money on the tram, including OHSU, which did spend the money on the tram. They're the largest investor in it, and they're totally getting their money's
That's
worth.
Interesting.
But the city of Portland is less happy with it.
The tram is our oven ring.
Well, I'm sitting here imagining what you just said, Lily, about everybody who uses it is not skeptical. If you just replace the word tram with cycle track on Sandy.
Right, right. Yeah.
It'd be the exact same thing. See, but people, you know, if we had aerial tram lobby.
Right.
They're stoked because they have a proof of concept that just is awesome, and they can point to all these great stats. Unfortunately, we don't necessarily have that, but you know, so that would be
car lobby, and then you'd be elected in mayor.
That's right.
Sorry.
So to go back to like if Peabot had a healthy budget, I wonder what it would do to people that spend time advocating for bicycling as an argument, you know, making a case for it. Will we have to do a better job at that, or could we sit back and say, oh, the city's got our back, and now they have the money, so
well,
they're gonna build our stuff, or will we have to like would people that advocate for cycling have to like really bring their A game to compete? In this new arena where there's everybody's got their interests and potential to have their stuff funded, you know?
Right. So that's the latter for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, the more money there is and the more hands will come into the table as well. Right.
Yeah.
So you might actually see the auto lobby or the freight folks would be very excited. Right. They've got all the big ticket items.
A lot of my friends would have much more better and frequent parties because I know a lot of people that work at the city.
Yeah. And they would stop being so sad.
Yeah, right.
People would show up.
Yeah. I guess the question is, what if a healthy budget where we can build all the stuff, or is there what if an infinite budget?
Yeah, right. That's true. We got kind of carried away. Not surprised.
All right.
What if someone invented a mode of transportation that was actually better than bicycling, more fun, just more awesome, more efficient, faster for short urban trips?
Nah.
That's not going to happen. That's right. A dumb question.
Lily, do you have some TriMet tweets?
I do. David Suarez says, my commute is 1.5 hours both way, and I'm really bony. I'd pay you extra for a comfortable seat, TriMet. Dan Christensen, our tweeting TriMet driver, sad to report that TriMet has yet to equip a single bus with a disco ball. We can only hope. Telemachus Rome. Three dudes sitting on the Yellow Line Max, counting their cash, wondering how long they can make the weekend last. TriMet. Hashtag drugs.
Sounds like a good time.
Telemachus Rome again. So many parties on TriMet Max. Voted America's funnest transit system 7 years running.
That's true.
I wonder why seven.
Is that true?
I saw a party on the Max last night. It was great. People were having fun. Public transportation is great.
I'm pretty sure that Ellie Blue had her graduation party on the Max.
All right.
But I will say, I have been to much funner urban transportation systems.
Oh, yeah?
Berlin, the Ring Line, New Year's Eve is where the party's at. Like, people set up whole bars inside of the train and, like, just hand out drinks to strangers.
Well, you go to a whole conference in a train, don't you? The geek train thing?
Nerd train. Specific.
Oh, sorry.
Geeks bite the heads off chickens. Mm. Nerds hang out on trains.
I want that on a t-shirt.
And that's our show.
You
can subscribe to the show at bikeportland.org/podcast and send us any comments you have at podcast@bikeportland.org.
You can spread the word about the show by searching for Bike Portland on iTunes and leaving a review.
You can follow me @anomalily on Twitter.
And you can follow Bike Portland on Twitter and Facebook too. I'm Jonathan Maas, Bike Portland's publisher.
I'm Mike Anderson, Bike Portland's news editor.
And I'm Lillian Carabake, your podcast producer. Thanks for listening. Until next time, remember to exit through the back,
pass on the left,
and don't forget to thank your bus driver.